Upstairs? Where? He was startled at that. The smith's forge was downstairs from where he was, off the courtyard. And they wouldn't flog him so late in the evening. The man's face twisted, fierce and ruddy in the torchlight.
To the major's quarters, the guard said, grinning. And may God have mercy on your soul, MacDhu.
No, sir. I will not say where I have been. He repeated it firmly, trying not to let his teeth chatter. He had been brought not to the office, but to Grey's private sitting room. There was a fire on the hearth, but Grey was standing in front of it, blocking most of the warmth.
Nor why you chose to escape.
Grey's voice was cool and formal. Jamie's face tightened. He had been placed near the bookshelf, where the light of a triple-branched candlestick fell on his face. Grey himself was no more than a silhouette, black against the fire's glow.
"That is my private affair," he said. "Private affair?" Grey echoed incredulously. "Did you say your private affair?"
"I did."
The governor inhaled strongly through his nose.
"That is possibly the most outrageous thing I have heard in my life."
"Your life has been rather brief, then, Major," Fraser said, "if you will pardon my seeing so."
There was no point in dragging it out or trying to placate the man. Better to provoke a decision at once and get it over with. He had certainly provoked something. Grey's fists clenched tight at his sides, and he took a step toward him, away from the fire.
"Have you any notion what I could do to you for this?"
Grey inquired, his voice low and very much controlled.
"Aye, I have, Major."
More than a notion. He knew from experience what they might do to him, and he wasn't looking forward to it. It wasn't as though he'd a choice about it, though. Grey breathed heavily for a moment, then jerked his head.
"Come here, Mr. Fraser," he ordered.
Jamie stared at him, puzzled.
"Here,"
he said peremptorily, pointing to a spot directly before him on the hearthrug.
"Stand here, sir." "I'm not a dog, Major," Jamie snapped. "You'll do as you like with me, but I'll no come when you call me to heel."
Taken by surprise, Grey uttered a short, involuntary laugh.
"My apologies, Mr. Fraser," he said dryly. "I meant no offence by the address. I merely wish you to approach nearer, if you will."
He stepped aside and bowed elaborately, gesturing to the hearth. Jamie hesitated, but then stepped warily onto the patterned rug. Grey stepped close to him, nostrils flared. So close, the fine bones and fair skin of his face made him look almost girlish. The Major put a hand on his sleeve, and the long-lashed eyes sprang wide in shock.
"You're wet."
"Yes, I am wet," Jamie said with elaborate patience. He was also freezing.
A fine, continuous shiver ran through him, even this close to the fire.
"Why?"
"Why?"
Jamie echoed, astonished.
"Did you not order the guards to douse me with water before leaving me in a freezing cell?" "I did not, no."
It was clear enough that the Major was telling the truth. His face was pale under the ruddy flash of the firelight, and he looked angry. His lips thinned to a fine line.
"I apologise for this, Mr. Fraser."
"Accepted, Major."
Small wisps of steam were beginning to rise from his clothes, but the warmth was seeping through the damp cloth. His muscles ached from the shivering, and he wished he could lie down on the hearthrug, dog or not.
"Did your escape have anything to do with the matter of which you learned at the Lime Tree Inn?"
Jamie stood silent. The ends of his hair were drying, and small wisps floated across his face.
"Will you swear to me that your escape had nothing to do with that matter?"
Jamie stood silent.
There seemed no point in saying anything now.
The little Major was pacing up and down the hearth before him, hands locked behind his back. Now and then the Major glanced up at him and then resumed his pacing. Finally, he stopped in front of Jamie.
"Mr. Fraser," he said formally, I will ask you once more. Why did you escape from the prison?
Jamie sighed. He wouldn't get to stand by the fire much longer.
I cannot tell you, Major.
Cannot or will not? Gray asked sharply.
It doesn't seem a useful distinction, Major, as you will not hear anything either way.
He closed his eyes and waited, trying to soak up as much heat as possible before they took him away. Gray found himself at a loss, both for words and action.
Stubborn does not begin to describe it, Quarry had said.
It didn't.
He took a deep breath, wondering what to do. He found himself embarrassed by the petty cruelty of the guard's revenge, the more so because it was just such an action he had first contemplated upon hearing that Fraser was his prisoner. He would be perfectly within his rights now to order the man flogged or put back in irons. Condemned to solitary confinement, put on short rations, he could, in justice, inflict any of a dozen different punishments. And if he did, the odds of his ever finding the Frenchman's gold became vanishingly small. The gold did exist. Or at least there was a good probability that it did. Only a belief in that gold would have stirred Fraser to act as he had. He eyed the man. Fraser's eyes were closed, his lips set firmly. He had a wide, strong mouth, whose grim expression was somewhat belied by the sensitive lips, set soft and exposed in their curly nest of red beard. Gray paused, trying to think of some way to break past the man's wall of bland defiance. To use force would be worse than useless, and after the guard's actions he would be ashamed to order it, even had he the stomach for brutality. The clock on the mantelpiece struck 10. It was late. There was no sound in the fortress, save the occasional footsteps of the soldier on sentry in the courtyard outside the window. Clearly, neither force nor threat would work in gaining the truth. Reluctantly, he realized there was only one course open to him if he still wished to pursue the gold. He must put aside his feelings about the man and take Quarry's suggestion. He must pursue an acquaintance, in the course of which he might worm out of the man some clue that would lead him to the hidden treasure. If it existed, he reminded himself, turning to his prisoner. He took a deep breath. "Mr. Fraser," he said formally, "will you do me the honour to take supper tomorrow in my quarters?" He had the momentary satisfaction of having startled the Scottish bastard, at least. The blue eyes opened wide, and then Fraser regained the mastery of his face. He paused for a moment, and then bowed with a flourish, as though he wore a kilt and swinging plaid, and not damp prison rags.
"It will be my pleasure to attend you, Major," he said.
This ends Disc 5. Voyager, Disc 6.
March the 7th, 1755. Fraser was delivered by the guard and left to wait in the sitting room where a table was laid. When Gray came through the door from his bedroom a few moments later, he found his guest standing by the bookshelf, apparently absorbed in a copy of Nouvelle Héloïse. "You're interested in French novels?" he blurted, not realizing until too late how incredulous the question sounded. Fraser glanced up, startled, and snapped the book shut. Very deliberately, he returned it to its shelf.
"I can read, Major," he said.
He had shaved. A slight flush burned high on his cheekbones.
Yes, of course, I didn't mean... I merely..."
Gray's own cheeks were more flushed than Fraser's. The fact was that he had subconsciously assumed that the other didn't read, his evident education notwithstanding, merely because of his Highland accent and shabby dress. While his coat might be shabby, Fraser's manners were not. He ignored Gray's flustered apology and turned to the bookshelf.
"I have been telling the men the story, but it has been some time since I read it. I thought I would refresh my memory as to the sequence of the ending." "I see."
Just in time, Gray stopped himself from saying, "They understand it?" Fraser evidently read the unspoken question in his face, for he said dryly,
"All Scottish children are taught their letters, Major. Still, we have a great tradition of storytelling in the Highlands." "Ah, yes, I see."
The entry of his servant with dinner saved him from further awkwardness, and the supper passed uneventfully, though there was little conversation, and that little limited to the affairs of the prison. The next time, he had had the chess table set up before the fire and invited Fraser to join him in a game before the supper was served. There had been a brief flash of surprise from the slanted blue eyes, and then a nod of acquiescence. That had been a small stroke of genius, Grey thought in retrospect. Relieved of the need for conversation or social courtesies, they had slowly become accustomed to each other as they sat over the inlaid board of ivory and ebony wood, gauging each other silently by the movements of the chessmen. When they had at length sat down to dine, they were no longer quite strangers, and the conversation, while still wary and formal, was at least true conversation, and not the awkward affair of starts and stops it had been before. They discussed matters of the prison, had a little conversation of books, and parted formally, but on good terms. Grey did not mention gold. And so the weekly custom was established. Grey sought to put his guest at ease, in the hopes that Fraser might let drop some clue to the fate of the Frenchman's gold. It hadn't come, so far, despite careful probing. Any hint of inquiry as to what had transpired during the 3 days of Fraser's absence from Ardsmuir met with silence. Over the mutton and boiled potatoes, he did his best to draw his odd guest into a discussion of France and its politics, by way of discovering whether there might exist any links between Fraser and a possible source of gold from the French court. Much to his surprise, he was informed that Fraser had, in fact, spent 2 years living in France, employed in the wine business, prior to the Stuart Rebellion. A certain cool humour in Fraser's eyes indicated that the man was well aware of the motives behind this questioning. At the same time, he acquiesced gracefully enough in the conversation, though taking some care always to lead questions away from his personal life, and instead toward more general matters of art and society. Grey had spent some time in Paris, and despite his attempts at probing Fraser's French connections, found himself becoming interested in the conversation for its own sake. "Tell me, Mr. Fraser, during your time in Paris, did you chance to encounter the dramatic works of Monsieur Voltaire?" Fraser smiled. "Oh, aye, Major. In fact, I was privileged to entertain Monsieur Arouet, Voltaire being his nom de plume, at my table on more than one occasion." "Really?" Grey cocked a brow in interest. "And is he as great a wit in person as with the pen?" "I couldn't really say," Fraser replied, tidily forking up a slice of mutton. "He seldom said anything at all, let alone much sparkling wee wit. He only sat hunched over his chair, watching everyone wi' his eyes rolling about from one to another. I shouldn't at all be surprised to hear that things said at my dinner table later appeared on the stage, though fortunately I never encountered a parody of myself in his work." He closed his eyes in momentary concentration, chewing his mutton. "Is the meat to your taste, Mr. Fraser?" Grey inquired politely. It was gristled, tough, and seemed barely edible to him, but then he might well think differently had he been eating oatmeal, weeds, and the occasional rat. "Aye, it is, Major. I thank you." Fraser dabbed up a bit of wine sauce and brought the last bite to his lips, making no demur when Grey signalled Mackay to bring back the platter. "Monsieur Arouet wouldn't appreciate such an excellent meal, I'm afraid," Fraser said, shaking his head as he helped himself to more mutton. "I should expect a man so fêted in French society to have somewhat more exacting tastes," Grey answered dryly. Half his own meal remained on his plate, destined for the supper of the cat Augustus. Fraser laughed.
Scarcely that, Major, he assured Grey. I have never seen Monsieur Arouet consume anything beyond a glass of water and a dry biscuit, no matter how lavish the occasion. He's a wizened wee scrap of a man, you ken, and a martyr to the indigestion. Indeed.
Grey was fascinated.
Perhaps that explains the cynicism of some of the sentiments I have seen expressed in his plays. Or do you not think that the character of an author shows in the construction of his work?
Given some of the characters that I have seen appear in plays and novels, Major, I should think the author a bit depraved who drew them entirely from himself, no?
I suppose that is so,
Grey answered, smiling at the thought of some of the more extreme fictional characters with whom he was acquainted.
Though, if an author constructs these colourful personages from life rather than from the depths of imagination, surely he must boast a most varied acquaintance.
Fraser nodded, brushing crumbs from his lap with the linen napkin.
It was not Monsieur Arouet, but a colleague of his, a lady novelist, who remarked to me once that writing novels was a cannibal's art, in which one often mixed small portions of one's friends and one's enemies together, seasoned them with imagination, and allowed the whole to stew together into a savoury concoction.
Grey laughed at the description, and beckoned to Mackay to take away the plates and bring in the decanters of port and sherry.
A delightful description indeed. Speaking of cannibals, though, have you chanced to be acquainted with Mr. Defoe's Robinson Crusoe? It has been a favourite of mine since boyhood.
The conversation turned then to romances and the excitement of the tropics. It was very late indeed when Fraser returned to his cell, leaving Major Grey entertained, but no wiser concerning either the source or the disposition of the Wanderer's gold. April the 2nd, 1755. John Grey opened the packet of quills his mother had sent from London. Swan's quills, both finer and stronger than common goose quills. He smiled faintly at the sight of them, an unsubtle reminder that his correspondence was in arrears. His mother would have to wait until tomorrow, though. He took out the small monogrammed penknife he always carried and slowly trimmed a quill to his liking, composing in his mind what he meant to say. By the time he dipped his quill into the ink, the words were clear in his mind and he wrote quickly, seldom pausing.
2nd of April, 1755, to Harold, Lord Melton, Earl of Moray. My dear Hal, he wrote, I write to inform you of a recent occurrence which has much engaged my attention. It may amount in the end to nothing, but if there be any substance in the matter, it is of great import.
The details of the wandering man's appearance and the report of his ravings followed swiftly. But Grey found himself slowing as he told of Fraser's escape and recapture.
The fact that Fraser vanished from the precincts of the prison so soon following these events suggests strongly to me that there was in truth some substance in the vagrant's words. If this were the case, however, I find myself at a loss to account for Fraser's subsequent actions. He was recaptured within 3 days of his escape at a point no more than a mile from the coast. The countryside beyond the prison is deserted for a great many miles beyond the village of Ardsmuir, and there is little likelihood of his meeting with a confederate to whom he might pass word of the treasure. Every house in the village has been searched, as was Fraser himself, with no trace discovered of any gold. It is a remote district, and I am reasonably sure that he communicated with no one outside the prison prior to his escape. I am positive that he has not done so since, for he is closely watched.
Grey stopped, seeing once more the windswept figure of James Fraser, wild as the red stags, and as much at home on the moor as one of them. He hadn't the slightest doubt that Fraser could have eluded the dragoons easily, had he so chosen. But he had not. He had deliberately allowed himself to be recaptured. Why? He resumed writing more slowly.
It may be, of course, that Fraser failed to find the treasure, or that such a treasure doesn't exist. I find myself somewhat inclined to this belief, for if he were in possession of a great sum, surely he would have departed from the district at once. He is a strong man, well accustomed to rough living, and entirely capable, I believe, of making his way overland to some point on the coast from which he might make an escape by sea.
Grey bit the end of the quill gently, tasting ink. He made a face at the bitterness, rose, and spat out of the window. He stood there for a minute, looking out into the cold spring night, absently wiping his mouth. It had finally occurred to him to ask, not the question he had been asking all along, but the more important one. He had done it at the conclusion of a game of chess, which Fraser had won. The guard was standing at the door, ready to escort Fraser back to his cell. As the prisoner had risen from his seat, Grey had stood up too.
"I shall not ask you again why you left the prison," he had said, calmly conversational. "But I will ask you, why did you come back?"
Fraser had frozen briefly, startled. He turned back and met Grey's eyes directly. For a moment he said nothing, then his mouth curled up in a smile.
"I suppose I must value the company, Major. I can tell you, it's not the food."
Grey snorted slightly, remembering. Unable to think of a suitable response, he had allowed Fraser to leave. It was only later that night that he had laboriously arrived at an answer, at last having had the wit to ask questions of himself rather than of Fraser. What would he, Grey, have done had Fraser not returned? The answer was that his next step would have been an inquiry into Fraser's family connections, in case the man had sought refuge or help from them. And that, he was fairly sure, was the answer. Grey had not taken part in the subjugation of the Highlands. He had been posted to Italy and France. But he had heard more than enough of that particular campaign. He had seen the blackened stones of too many charred cottages rising like cairns amid the ruined fields as he travelled north towards Muir. The fierce loyalties of the Scottish Highlanders were legendary. A Highlander who had seen those cots in flames might well choose to suffer prison, irons, or even flogging to save his family a visitation from English soldiers. Grey sat up and took up his quill, dipping it afresh.
"You will know, I think, the mettle of the Scots," he wrote.
"That one in particular," he thought wryly.
"It is unlikely that any force or threat I can exert will induce Fraser to reveal the whereabouts of the gold, should it exist. And if it does not, I can still less expect any threat to be effective. I have instead chosen to begin a formal acquaintance with Fraser in his capacity as chief of the Scottish prisoners, in hopes of surprising some clue from his conversation. So far, I have gained nothing from this process. One further avenue of approach suggests itself, however. For obvious reasons," he went on, writing slowly as he formed the thought, "I do not wish to make this matter known officially."
To call attention to a hoard that might well prove to be chimerical was dangerous. The chance of disappointment was too great. Time enough, if the gold were found, to inform his superiors and collect his deserved reward. Escape from Ardsmuir. A posting back to civilization.
"Therefore, I approach you, dear brother, and ask your help in discovering what particulars may obtain regarding the family of James Fraser. I pray you, do not let anyone be alarmed by your inquiries. If such family connections exist, I would have them ignorant of my interest for the present. My deepest thanks for any efforts you may be able to exert on my behalf. And believe me, always..."
He dipped the pen once more and signed with a small flourish.
"Your humble servant and most affectionate brother, John William Grey."
May 15, 1755.
"The men sick of La Grippe?" Grey inquired.
How do they fare?
Dinner was over, and with it their conversation of books. Now it was time for business. Fraser frowned over the single glass of sherry that was all he would accept in the way of drink. He still hadn't tasted it, though dinner had been over for some time.
None so well. I have more than 60 men ill, 15 of them very badly off.
He hesitated.
Might I ask?
I can promise nothing, Mr. Fraser, but you may ask, Gray answered formally.
He had barely sipped his own sherry, nor more than tasted his dinner. His stomach had been knotted with anticipation all day. Jamie paused a moment longer, calculating his chances. He wouldn't get everything. He must try for what was most important, but leave Gray room to reject some requests.
We have need of more blankets, Major, more fires and more food, and medicines.
Gray swirled the sherry in his cup, watching the light from the fire play in the vortex.
Ordinary business first, he reminded himself. Time enough for the other later. We have no more than 20 spare blankets in store, he answered, but you may have those for the use of the very sick. I fear I cannot augment the ration of food. The rat spoilage has been considerable, and we lost a great quantity of meal in the collapse of the storeroom 2 months ago. We have limited resources, and...
It is not so much a question of more, Fraser put in quickly, but rather of the type of food. Those who are most ill cannot readily digest the bread and porridge. Perhaps a substitution of some sort might be arranged.
Each man was given, by law, a quart of oatmeal porridge and a small wheaten loaf each day. Thin barley brose supplemented this twice each week, with a quart of meat stew added on Sunday to sustain the needs of men working at manual labour for 12 to 16 hours per day. Gray raised one eyebrow.
What are you suggesting, Mr. Fraser?
I assume that the prison does have some allowance for the purchase of salt beef, turnips and onions for the Sunday stew.
Yes, but that allowance must provide for the next quarter's supplies.
Then what I suggest, Major, is that you might use that money now to provide broth and stew for those who are sick. Those of us who are hale will willingly forgo our share of meat for the quarter.
Gray frowned.
But will the prisoners not be weakened with no meat at all? Will they not be unable to work?
Those who die of the grip will assuredly not work, Fraser pointed out acerbically.
Gray snorted briefly.
True. But those of you who remain healthy will not be healthy long if you give up your rations for so long a time.
He shook his head.
No, Mr. Fraser, I think not. It is better to let the sick take their chances than to risk many more falling ill.
Fraser was a stubborn man. He lowered his head for a moment, then looked up to try again.
Then I would ask your leave to hunt for ourselves, Major, if the Crown cannot supply us with adequate food. Hunt?
Gray's fair brows rose in astonishment.
Give you weapons and allow you to wander the moors? God's teeth, Mr. Fraser!
I think God doesn't suffer much from the scurvy, Major,
Jamie said dryly.
His teeth are in no danger.
He saw the twitch of Gray's mouth and relaxed slightly. Gray always tried to suppress his sense of humour, no doubt feeling that put him at a disadvantage.
In his dealings with Jamie Fraser, it did.
Emboldened by that telltale twitch, Jamie pressed on.
Not weapons, Major, and not wandering. Will you give us leave to set snares upon the moor when we cut peats, though, and to keep such meat as we take?
A prisoner would now and then contrive a snare, as it was, but as often as not, the catch would be taken from him by the guards. Gray drew a deep breath and blew it out slowly, considering.
Snares? Would you not require materials for the construction of these snares, Mr. Fraser?
Only a bit of string, Major, Jamie assured him.
A dozen balls, no more, of any sort of twine or string, and you may leave the rest to us.
Gray rubbed slowly at his cheek in contemplation, then nodded.
Very well.
The Major turned to the small secretary, plucked the quill out of its inkwell, and made a note.
I shall give orders to that effect tomorrow. Now, as to the rest of your requests.
A quarter of an hour later, it was settled. Jamie sat back at last, sighing, and finally took a sip of his sherry. He considered that he had earned it. He had permission not only for the snares, but for the peat cutters to work an extra half hour per day, the extra peats to provide for an additional small fire in each cell. No medicines were to be had, but he had leave for Sutherland to send a message to a cousin in Ullapool, whose husband was an apothecary. If the cousin's husband were willing to send medicines, the prisoners could have them. A decent evening's work, Jamie thought. He took another sip of sherry and closed his eyes, enjoying the warmth of the fire against his cheek. Grey watched his guest beneath lowered lids, seeing the broad shoulders slump a little, tension ease now that their business was finished. Or so Fraser thought. Very good, Grey thought to himself. Yes, drink your sherry and relax. I want you thoroughly off guard. He leaned forward to pick up the decanter and felt the crackle of Hal's letter in his breast pocket. His heart began to beat faster.
Will you not take a drop more, Mr. Fraser? And tell me, how does your sister fare these days?
He saw Fraser's eyes spring open and his face whiten with shock.
How are matters there at Lallybroch, they call it, do they not?
Grey pushed aside the decanter, keeping his eyes fixed on his guest.
I could not see, Major.
Fraser's voice was even, but his eyes were narrowed to slits.
No? But I dare say they do very well these days, what with the gold you have provided them.
The broad shoulders tightened suddenly, bunched under the shabby coat. Grey carelessly picked up one of the chessmen from the nearby board, tossing it casually from one hand to the other.
I suppose Ian, your brother-in-law is named Ian, I think, will know how to make good use of it.
Fraser had himself under control again. The dark blue eyes met Grey's directly.
Since you are so well informed as to my connections, Major, he said evenly, I must suppose that you also are aware that my home lies well over 100 miles from Ardsmuir. Perhaps you will explain how I might have travelled that distance twice within the space of 3 days.
Grey's eyes stayed on the chess piece, rolling idly from hand to hand. It was a pawn, a cone-headed little warrior with a fierce face, carved from a cylinder of walrus ivory.
You might have met someone upon the moor who would have borne word of the gold, or borne the gold itself to your family.
Fraser snorted briefly.
On Ardsmuir? How likely is it, Major, that I should, by happenstance, encounter a person known to me on that moor? Much less that it should be a person whom I would trust to convey a message such as you suggest.
He set down his glass with finality.
I met no one on the moor, Major.
And should I trust your word to that effect, Mr. Fraser?
Grey allowed considerable scepticism to show in his voice. He glanced up, brows raised. Fraser's high cheekbones flushed slightly.
No one has ever had cause to doubt my word, Major, he said stiffly.
Have they not indeed?
Grey was not altogether feigning his anger.
I believe you gave me your word upon the occasion of my ordering your irons stricken off. And I kept it. Did you?
The two men sat upright, glaring at each other over the table.
You asked 3 things of me, Major, and I've kept that bargain in every particular.
Grey gave a contemptuous snort.
Indeed, Mr. Fraser. And if that is so, pray, what was it caused you suddenly to despise the company of your fellows and seek congress with the conies on the moor? Since you assure me that you met no one else, you give me your word that it is so?
This last was spoken with an audible sneer that brought the colour surging into Fraser's face. One of the big hands curled slowly into a fist.
"Aye, Major," he said softly. "I give you my word that that is so."
He seemed to realise at this point that his fist was clenched. Very slowly he unfolded it, laying his hand flat on the table.
"And as to your escape?"
"And as to my escape, Major, I have told you that I will say nothing."
Fraser exhaled slowly and sat back in his chair, eyes fixed on Grey under thick, ruddy brows. Grey paused for a moment, then sat back himself, setting the chess piece on the table.
"Let me speak plainly, Mr. Fraser. I do you the honour of assuming you to be a sensible man."
"I am deeply sensible of the honour, Major, I do assure you."
Grey heard the irony, but didn't respond. He held the upper hand now.
"The fact is, Mr. Fraser, that it is of no consequence whether you did in fact communicate with your family regarding the matter of the gold. You might have done so. That possibility alone is sufficient to warrant my sending a party of dragoons to search the premises of Lallybroch thoroughly, and to arrest and interrogate the members of your family."
He reached into his breast pocket and withdrew a piece of paper. Unfolding it, he read the list of names.
"Ian Murray, your brother-in-law, I collect. His wife, Janet. That would be your sister, of course. Their children, James, named for his uncle, perhaps."
He glanced up briefly, long enough to catch a glimpse of Fraser's face, then returned to his list.
"Margaret, Catherine, Janet, Michael, and Ian." "Quite a brood," he said, in a tone of dismissal that equated the six younger Murrays with a litter of piglets.
He laid the list on the table beside the chess piece.
"The three eldest children are old enough to be arrested and interrogated with their parents, you know. Such interrogations are frequently ungentle, Mr. Fraser."
In this he spoke no less than the truth, and Fraser knew it. All colour had faded from the prisoner's face, leaving the strong bones stark under the skin. He closed his eyes briefly, then opened them. Grey had a brief memory of Quarry's voice saying,
"If you dine alone with a man, don't turn your back on him."
The hair rose briefly on the back of his neck, but he controlled himself, returning Fraser's blue stare.
"What do you want of me?"
The voice was low and hoarse with fury, but the Scot sat motionless, a figure carved in cinnabar, gilded by the flame. Grey took a deep breath.
"I want the truth," he said softly.
There was no sound in the chamber save the pop and hiss of the peats in the grate. There was a flicker of movement from Fraser, no more than the twitch of his fingers against his leg, and then nothing. The Scot sat, head turned, staring into the fire as though he sought an answer there. Grey sat quietly, waiting. He could afford to wait. At last, Fraser turned back to face him.
"The truth, then."
He took a deep breath. Grey could see the breast of his linen shirt swell with it. He had no waistcoat.
"I kept my word, Major. I told you faithfully all that the man said to me that night. What I didn't tell you was some of the things he said had meaning to me."
"Indeed."
Grey held himself still, scarcely daring to move.
"And what meaning was that?"
Fraser's wide mouth compressed to a thin line.
"I spoke to you of my wife,"
he said, forcing the words out as though they hurt him.
"Yes, you said that she was dead."
"I said that she was gone, Major,"
Fraser corrected softly. His eyes were fixed on the pawn.
"It is likely she is dead, but..."
He stopped and swallowed, then went on more firmly.
"My wife was a healer, what they call in the Highlands a charmer, but more than that, she was a white lady, a wise woman."
He glanced up briefly.
The word in Gaelic is bandroi. It also means witch.
The White Witch. Grey also spoke softly, but excitement was thrumming through his blood.
So the man's words referred to your wife?
I thought they might.
And if so?
The wide shoulders stirred in a slight shrug.
I had to go, he said simply.
To see. How did you know where to go? Was that also something you gleaned from the vagrant's words?
Grey leaned forward slightly, curious. Fraser nodded, eyes still fixed on the ivory chess piece.
There is a spot I knew of, not too far distance from this place, where there is a shrine to St. Bride. St. Bride was also called the White Lady, he explained, looking up. Though the shrine has been there a very long time, since long before St. Bride came to Scotland.
I see. And so you assumed that the man's words referred to this spot as well as to your wife?
Again the shrug.
I did not know, Fraser repeated. I couldn't say whether he meant anything to do with my wife, or whether the White Witch only meant St. Bride, was only meant to direct me to the place, or perhaps neither. But I felt I must go.
He described the place in question, and at Grey's prodding gave directions for reaching it.
The shrine itself is a small stone in the shape of an ancient cross, so weathered that the markings scarce show on it. It stands above a small pool half buried in the heather. You can find small white stones in the pool, tangled among the roots of the heather that grows on the bank. The stones are thought to have great powers, Major, he explained, seeing the other's blank look, but only when used by a white lady.
I see. And your wife?
Grey paused delicately. Fraser shook his head briefly.
There was nothing there to do with her, he said softly. She is truly gone.
His voice was low and controlled, but Grey could hear the undertone of desolation. Fraser's face was normally calm and unreadable. He didn't change expression now, but the marks of grief were clear, etched in the lines beside mouth and eyes, thrown into darkness by the flickering fire. It seemed an intrusion to break in upon such a depth of feeling, unstated though it was. But Grey had his duty.
And the gold, Mr. Fraser, he asked quietly. What of that?
Fraser heaved a deep sigh.
It was there,
he said flatly.
What?
Grey sat bolt upright in his chair, staring at the Scot.
You found it?
Fraser glanced up at him then, and his mouth twisted wryly.
I found it.
Was it indeed the French gold that Louis sent for Charles Stuart?
Excitement was racing through Grey's bloodstream, with visions of himself delivering great chests of gold louis d'or to his superiors in London.
Louis never sent gold to the Stuarts, Fraser said with certainty.
No, Major. What I found at the Saint's Pool was gold, but not French coin.
What he had found was a small box containing a few gold and silver coins and a small leather pouch filled with jewels.
Jewels? Grey blurted. Where the devil did they come from?
Fraser cast him a glance of mild exasperation.
Have not the slightest notion, Major, he said.
How should I know?
No, of course not, Grey said, coughing to cover his flusterment.
Certainly. But this treasure, where is it now?
I threw it into the sea.
Grey stared blankly at him.
You what?
I threw it into the sea,
Fraser repeated patiently. The slanted blue eyes met Grey's steadily.
You'll maybe have heard of a place called the Devil's Cauldron, Major. It's no more than half a mile from the Saint's Pool.
Why? Why would you have done such a thing? Grey demanded. It isn't sense, man.
I wasn't much concerned with sense at the time, Major,
Fraser said softly.
I had gone there hoping, and with that hope gone. The treasure seemed no more to me than a wee box of stones and bits of tarnished metal. I had no use for it.
He looked up, one brow slightly raised in irony.
but I didn't see the sense in giving it to King Geordie either, so I flung it into the sea.
Grey sat back in his chair and mechanically poured out another cup of sherry, hardly noticing what he was doing. His thoughts were in turmoil. Fraser sat, head turned away, and chin propped on his fist, gazing into the fire, his face gone back to its usual impassivity. The light glowed behind him, lighting the long straight line of his nose and the soft curve of his lip, shadowing jaw and brow with sternness. Grey took a good-sized swallow of his drink and steadied himself.
"It is a moving story, Mr. Fraser," he said levelly. "Most dramatic. And yet there is no evidence that it is the truth."
Fraser stirred, turning his head to look at Grey. Jamie's slanted eyes narrowed in what might have been amusement.
"Aye, there is, Major," he said.
He reached under the waistband of his ragged breeches, fumbled for a moment, and held out his hand above the tabletop, waiting. Grey extended his own hand in reflex, and a small object dropped into his open palm. It was a sapphire, dark blue as Fraser's own eyes, and a good size, too. Grey opened his mouth, but said nothing, choked with astonishment.
"There is your evidence that the treasure existed, Major."
Fraser nodded toward the stone in Grey's hand. His eyes met Grey's across the tabletop.
"And as for the rest, I'm sorry to see, Major, that you must take my word for it."
But you said..."
"I did."
Fraser was as calm as though they had been discussing the rain outside.
"I kept that one wee stone, thinking that it might be some use if I were ever to be freed, or that I might find some chance of sending it to my family. For ye'll appreciate, Major..."
A light glinted derisively in Jamie's blue eyes.
"That my family couldn't make use of a treasure of that sort without attracting a deal of unwelcome attention. One stone, perhaps, but not a great many of them."
Grey could scarcely think. What Fraser said was true. A Highland farmer like his brother-in-law would have no way of turning such a treasure into money without causing talk that would bring down the king's men on Lallybroch in short order. And Fraser himself might well be imprisoned for the rest of his life. But still, to toss away a fortune so lightly. And yet, looking at the Scot, he could well believe it. If ever there was a man whose judgment would not be distorted by greed, James Fraser was it. Still...
"How did you keep this by you?" Grey demanded abruptly. "You were searched to the skin when you were brought back."
The wide mouth curved slightly in the first genuine smile Grey had seen.
"I swallowed it," Fraser said.
Grey's hand closed convulsively on the sapphire. He opened his hand and rather gingerly set the gleaming blue thing on the table by the chess piece.
"I see," he said. "I'm sure you do, Major," said Fraser,
with a gravity that merely made the glint of amusement in his eyes more pronounced.
"A diet of rough porridge has its advantages now and again."
Grey quelled the sudden urge to laugh, rubbing a finger hard over his lip.
"I'm sure it does, Mr. Fraser."
He sat for a moment, contemplating the blue stone. Then he looked up abruptly.
"You are a papist, Mr. Fraser."
He knew the answer already. There were few adherents of the Catholic Stuarts who were not. Without waiting for a reply, he rose and went to the bookshelf in the corner. It took a moment to find. A gift from his mother. It wasn't part of his usual reading. He laid the calf-bound Bible on the table next to the stone.
"I am myself inclined to accept your word as a gentleman, Mr. Fraser," he said. "But you will understand that I have my duty to consider."
Fraser gazed at the book for a long moment, then looked up at Grey, his expression unreadable.
"Aye. I ken that fine, Major," he said quietly.
Without hesitation, he laid a broad hand on the Bible.
"I swear in the name of Almighty God and by his holy word," he said firmly, "the treasure is as I told you."
His eyes glowed in the firelight.
"And I swear on my hope of heaven," he added softly, "that it rests now in the sea."
Chapter 11. The Torremolinos Gambit. With the question of the French gold thus settled, they returned to what had become their routine, a brief period of formal negotiation over the affairs of the prisoners, followed by informal conversation and sometimes a game of chess. This evening they had come from the dinner table, still discussing Samuel Richardson's immense novel, Pamela.
"Do you think that the size of the book is justified by the complexity of the story?" Gray asked, leaning forward to light a cheroot from the candle on the sideboard. "It must, after all, be a great expense to the publisher, as well as requiring a substantial effort from the reader, a book of that length."
Fraser smiled. He didn't smoke himself, but had chosen to drink port this evening, claiming that to be the only drink whose taste would be unaffected by the stink of tobacco.
"What is it, 1,200 pages?"
"Aye, I think so. After all, it is difficult to sum up the complications of a life in a short space with any hope of constructing an accurate account."
"True. I have heard the point made, though, that the novelist's skill lies in the artful selection of detail. Do you not suppose that a volume of such length may indicate a lack of discipline in such selection, and hence a lack of skill?"
Fraser considered, sipping the ruby liquid slowly.
"I've seen books where that is the case, to be sure," he said.
"An author seeks by sheer inundation of detail to overwhelm the reader into belief. In this case, however, I think it isna so. Each character is most carefully considered, and all the incidents chosen seem necessary to the story. No, I think it is true that some stories simply require a greater space in which to be told."
He took another sip and laughed.
"Of course I admit to some prejudice in that regard, Major. Given the circumstances under which I read Pamela, I should have been delighted had the book been twice as long as it was."
"And what circumstances were those?"
Gray pursed his lips and blew a careful smoke ring that floated toward the ceiling.
"I lived in a cave in the Highlands for several years, Major," Fraser said wryly. "I seldom had more than 3 books with me, and those must last me for months at a time. Aye, I'm partial to lengthy tomes, but I must admit that it isn't a universal preference."
"That is certainly true," Gray agreed.
He squinted, following the track of the first smoke ring, and blew another. Just off target, it drifted to the side.
"I remember," he continued, sucking fiercely on his cheroot, encouraging it to draw. "A friend of my mother's saw the book in mother's drawing room."
He drew deeply and blew once more, giving a small grunt of satisfaction as the new ring struck the old, dispersing it into a tiny cloud.
"Lady Hensley it was. She picked up the book, looked at it in that helpless way so many females affect, and said, 'Oh, Countess, you are so courageous to attack a novel of such stupendous size. I fear I should never dare to start so lengthy a book myself.'"
Gray cleared his throat and lowered his voice from the falsetto he had affected for Lady Hensley.
"To which Mother replied," he went on in his normal voice, "'Don't worry about it for a moment, my dear. You wouldn't understand it anyway.'"
Fraser laughed, then coughed, waving away the remnants of another smoke ring. Gray quickly snuffed out the cheroot and rose from his seat.
"Come along, then. We've just time for a quick game."
They were not evenly matched. Fraser was much the better player, but Gray could, now and then, contrive to rescue a match through sheer bravado of play. Tonight he tried the Torremolinos Gambit. It was a risky opening, a Queen's Knight opening. Successfully launched, it paved the way for an unusual combination of rook and bishop, depending for its success upon a piece of misdirection by the king's knight and King Bishop's Pawn. Grey used it seldom, for it was a trick that wouldn't work on a mediocre player, one not sharp enough to detect the knight's threat or its possibilities. It was a gambit for use against a shrewd and subtle mind, and after nearly 3 months of weekly games, Grey knew quite well what sort of mind he was facing across the tinted ivory squares. He forced himself not to hold his breath as he made the next to final move of the combination. He felt Fraser's eyes rest on him briefly, but didn't meet them for fear of betraying his excitement. Instead, he reached to the sideboard for the decanter and refilled both glasses with the sweet dark port, keeping his eyes carefully on the rising liquid. Would it be the pawn or the knight? Fraser's head was bent over the board in contemplation, small reddish lights winking in his hair as he moved slightly. The knight, and all was well. It would be too late. The pawn and all was likely lost. Grey could feel his heart beating heavily behind his breastbone as he waited. Fraser's hand hovered over the board, then suddenly decided, swooped down and touched the piece. The knight. He must have let his breath out too noisily, for Fraser glanced sharply up at him, but it was too late. Careful to keep any overt expression of triumph off his face, Grey castled. Fraser frowned at the board for a long moment, eyes flicking among the pieces, assessing. Then he jerked slightly, seeing it, and looked up, eyes wide. "Why, you cunning wee bastard," he said, in a tone of surprised respect. "Where in the bloody hell did you learn that trick?" "My elder brother taught it to me," Grey answered, losing his customary wariness in a rush of delight at his success. He normally beat Fraser no more than 3 times in 10, and victory was sweet. Fraser uttered a short laugh, and reaching out a long index finger, delicately tipped his king over.
"I should have expected something like that from a man like my Lord Melton," he observed casually.
Grey stiffened in his seat. Fraser saw the movement and arched one brow quizzically.
"It is Lord Melton, you mean, is it not?" he said. "Or perhaps you have another brother?"
"No," Grey said. His lips felt slightly numb, though that might only be the cheroot.
"No, I have only one brother."
His heart had begun to pound again, but this time with a heavy, dull beat. Had the Scottish bastard remembered all the time who he was?
"Our meeting was necessarily rather brief," the Scot said dryly, "but memorable."
He picked up his glass and took a drink, watching Grey across the crystal rim.
"Perhaps you didn't know that I'd met Lord Melton on Culloden Field."
"I knew. I fought at Culloden."
All Grey's pleasure in his victory had evaporated. He felt slightly nauseated from the smoke.
"I didn't know that you would recall Hal, though, or know of the relationship between us.
As I have that meeting to thank for my life, I'm not likely to forget it,"
Fraser said dryly. Grey looked up.
"I understand that you were not so thankful when Hal met you at Culloden."
The line of Fraser's mouth tightened, then relaxed.
"No," he said softly.
He smiled without humour.
"Your brother very stubbornly refused to shoot me. I wasn't inclined to be grateful for the favour at the time."
"You wished to be shot?"
Grey's eyebrows rose. The Scot's eyes were remote, fixed on the chessboard, but clearly seeing something else.
"I thought I had reason," he said softly, "at the time."
"What reason?" Grey asked.
He caught a gimlet glance and added hastily,
"I mean no impertinence in asking. It is only, at that time, I felt similarly. From what you have said of the Stuarts, I cannot think that the loss of their cause would have led you to such despair."
There was a faint flicker near Fraser's mouth, much too faint to be called a smile. He inclined his head briefly in acknowledgement.
There were those who fought for love of Charles Stuart, or from loyalty to his father's right of kingship. But you are right.